The Culinary Institute of America held its 2014 Worlds of Flavor Conference at their Greystone campus in St. Helena, California. 70 chefs and presenters and over 700 attendees came together for Kitchens Connected on how creativity, millennial appetites, and culinary science are furthering the field of food. Carl Christian Fredrickson, Copenhagen Amons, New York City.
I was born in Aarhus, Denmark's second biggest city. My parents were there. My dad was in university. My mom was working. We moved after 3 months there. We moved to a small island called Langeland, outside of the island Fyn. A lot of my childhood was moving around until I was 3 years old. We moved to a town on the west coast of Zealand called Kalundborg, and I spent a lot of time there. Growing up with my parents and my mom's parents, and the food that we traditionally ate was very classical Danish. My mom used to work kitchens, but in retirement homes and in institutional homes. Everybody was used to cooking and cooking big portions, and my mom was always had a curiosity about food, so we ate a lot of classical food, but also she would try to make Hungarian goulash, or she would do some Thai soups and stuff like that. But I grew up from, my dad was a pig farmer and went to university to get a degree and started working as a consultant instead. But he still had a lot of ties to the business, so we would get a lot of pork. You know, he'll buy half a pig, we'll buy chickens, hand-fed chickens from the woods, and we had my mom had her own chickens, and we had eggs from there. So I grew up with the belief that only I don't know how to, like, less fortunate people would buy bread and buy jam. I thought everybody would do their own pickles and bake their own bread, because that's how I grew up, and nobody showed me otherwise.
Let's talk about traditional foods of your childhood.
It is meat and potatoes, gravy, the heavier, a lot of minced meat, I recall, a lot of minced meat, and the occasional, like, celebration dinners with whole roasted chickens and whole roasted rack of lamb and porks and stuff like that. It is very protein heavy. You know, salad was like a gift sometimes, you know, where you would eat it on the side of the plate. You had a special plate for your salad. So I grew up in the eating very heavy.
Danishes. Are they Danish?
No. They're actually Austrian. And in Denmark, we call it wienerbrød, or bread from Vienna. So traditionally, it is actually an Austrian recipe. I don't know how it became to be called Danishes in the U.S.
Other Danish foods that have made it to the U.S.?
The rye bread is picking up, but it's more of like a health thing, that you serve the kind of rye bread we have in Denmark. But the Danish food that I grew up with was also colored a lot by Italian and French food. And Scandinavian food, of course. Pickled herring is a huge thing in Denmark. You have that especially in New York, where I live now. Russian daughters and all the Jewish neighborhoods has a lot of pickled herrings. But none specific, like, this is clearly Danish food. I don't see that in the U.S.
So you call your restaurant New York's only Danish restaurant. Tell me about how the restaurant was concepted, when it started, its name, its location.
The concept started with our owner, Sunny Eating, having the idea of opening up a piece of Denmark in New York City, because she missed, like, the Danish feeling, architecture, like, just a room to be in. And she started talking to people about it, and she got to work together with Adam Oman from Copenhagen, who has two very, very beautiful restaurants in Copenhagen. He has a deli type of smørbrøds restaurant, and then he has a more bistro fine dine restaurant next to it. And they worked out to open this project in New York which is the sandwiches, the open-faced sandwiches for lunch, and a more new Nordic is a big word, but it's a more Nordic take on dining that we do at night.
What does that take? What does it comprise of?
It's not as protein heavy as the food I grew up with. We do a lot of we do a lot of vegetables. We do a lot of we go to the green market as often as we can to pick up all our vegetables. Actually, so we do a lot of fish. We brine a lot. We pickle a lot. We use a lot of we use a lot of fresh vegetables. Of course, right now it's because of the season. It's more durable and it's getting colder and people need more vitamin. People need more fat in their diet. So we opted a bit, but we are very seasonal. Changing the menu as often as we can.
Well, let's talk about diet in that aspect, because often you don't hear about how much fat a person should have in their diet. How do you cook? Do you cook towards a diet or towards a palate?
Towards a palate, by far. But yeah. I think the way we cook at the restaurant is more concerned about the palate than it is about the diet. But we do have it in mind, you know. We use sea buckthorn, very rich on vitamin C. We use a lot of bitter greens, which is very high on iron. We use the sea buckthorn. We try to use it as much as we can. It's hard to find. We source it from this fantastic guy in Canada. Very rich in vitamin C, very rich in acidic flavors. It's very fun to use because it's kind of like the Nordic lemon. It goes with savory, it goes with sweet. It's so diverse, and like the color, orange color, is so beautiful.
What is the Nordic lemon?
It's the sea buckthorn. The flavor is like the same acidity and the same bitterness. It's way more expensive to use, but we try to use it as much as the price allows us.
So we talked about rye very briefly. Let's kind of expand on that and tell me what rye is and how big a part of the Danish diet it is.
Rye is a huge part of the diet. It's in our rye bread that every kid in Denmark grew up eating. Rye bread is a dense, dark bread. People often confuse it with the pumpernickel, which it's not. It's often very heavy on grains and kernels. We use it as a base for our sandwiches that we eat for lunch and often for dinner. It's a healthier bread than your American white breads. I think it's tastier too. Of course, I love white bread, but everybody is amazed by white bread. But the rye bread is one of the things that I find myself missing when I'm not around it.
What are its flavor profiles?
It's more bitter than the sweet rye you have in the U.S. It's salty, the density gives it a very, very unique consistency.
Talk about smørrebrød. Is it called smørrebrød?
Smørrebrød. It's the O with the line through it is one of the letters in there. Smørrebrød is an open-faced sandwich, often seen with cold cuts, pickles. Somebody the other day described it as Scandinavian sushi, you know, which I'm not really fond of, but it is a very good picture. It's like small pieces of bread with a topping. Also, I also had a guy saying they ate it like they ate dim sum. So they would go to my restaurant and they would order everything and they would just share it to go through all the different flavors we have on the bread. But smørrebrød is a very classical Danish thing. You know, when I was a kid, it was something you got at christenings and at funerals. It is a lunch item, but people eat it for dinner too.
So I think it's pretty cool that you brought up like Jewish Ashkenazi food, now dim sum and sushi, to be able to explain Danish cuisine.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's easier to talk about things in an international sense than in a regional?
I think it's especially talking to American people. They have more ties to that kind of food than they do to the Scandinavian foods. And it's also like, it's the funny thing is, like, going out and eat Italian food in the U.S. I can recognize the red sauce and the pasta, but that's also almost it, you know. When I go to Italy, you never have meatballs and pasta together. It's like it's a crime. So I think for the Americans, they kind of have their own view of the international food. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because I love American Italian food. I love the American Chinese food, but it is different than the original food from the places where people came from once a long time ago. And I'm trying to keep my roots as firm in Denmark and not change it too much. But of course, I have to. My rye bread in my restaurant is a little bit more sweet than I would make it in Denmark. But it's not. Of course, it's on purpose. But the malt I get here is also a little bit more sweet. So it's kind of forced into the more sweet kitchen.
Talk about a couple of those other things you've had to reinterpret for a U.S. audience.
My liver pate is not as potent as it normally is. We cut off a lot of fat off our pork belly, cut a lot of fat off some of the cold cuts. We almost always feature salad on our menu. We always have soup, which is not normal for Danes to eat hot soup for lunch, but Americans love that, and I don't see a problem with it. I like soup too, you know, but I probably wouldn't have it for lunch. So we change things a lot like that. My food is also a little bit less salty. I still use a lot of salt, but my percentage in the food is a little bit less, because Americans are very concerned about salt.
Let's talk about how you keep connected to your roots and to Denmark. Do you read magazines, cookbooks from there, watch media?
No, not really. I talk to a lot of my chef friends in Denmark often, and when I'm home, three, four times a year, I go to restaurants. But I do most of my inspiration from Denmark is personal, from my friends and from my family.
Just talk about some of those personal experiences. What was your favorite smørrebrød? You know, growing up,
it was probably the egg and shrimp. But I'm unfortunately got allergic to shellfish. It was the roast beef sandwich with remoulade and crispy onions. Was like always a good. But growing up, like the ones I had in my lunchbox was liver pate, salami, mackerel in tomato sauce was like my favorites.
What were your least favorites?
Cheese. I just started eating cheese a couple of years ago. I couldn't stand it. Just the thought of it would make me feel sick. So yeah, cheese would be the one I wouldn't take ever.
So how did you introduce that into your you know, diet in a sense?
Cheese. I always have been very curious about food and always been wanting to. I had a huge dream about getting to learn to eat cheese. So I kind of forced myself into that world.
So force is a pretty harsh word. You know, there's obviously, you can break it down to elements. Like, what flavors were you looking for in cheese? What textures, or what did you not like, and that's what you had to overcome?
I think the texture was the hardest thing for me to overcome. I still have a hard time with blue cheese. I think it tastes rotten in the wrong way. Don't get me wrong, I ferment a lot of things. But I think the rotten of dairy products, just the smell is wrong to me. It lights up the signals of spoiled foods in a wrong way. So I had to overcome that. But I'm a huge fan of cheese now. My presentation right now, I used a crown dill cheese from Denmark in a porridge, which just gives so much flavor and richness to the dish.
So let's talk about more cheese applications. What else have you use cheese for in recipes?
Our menu at night at the restaurant, we feature cheese courses instead of a cheese platter to get people to eat more cheese, and cheese is such a big part of a lot of different cultures. So we want to give the cheese the right element, you know. It's a huge part of everybody's diet, and I don't see why you should eat like a blue cheese the same way as you eat a hard cheese, you know. So we do different courses with the cheeses to feature the cheese more.
Talk about those courses.
Those courses are, right now we have Jasper Hill cloth-aged cheddar. We serve it with a broken gel made from elderflower and fresh thyme leaves and rye puffs. So that salty, crumbly cheese carries with this sweet, flowery from both the thyme and the elderflowers, and then you have the rye puffs for the texture. We do a blue cheese dish right now. It's a frozen Danish blue that we grate over celery that is just slightly salted and had elderberry vinegar on it. So we kind of try to support the cheese without stealing too much from the cheese.
So you're almost treating cheese as your protein.
Or exactly. That's the idea about it.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that it's a personal thing, too. For you to overcome cheese, you had to change the concept of how cheese was eaten and served. That's awesome. Well, let's talk about a couple of the dishes you're serving here. What are you making?
Today I was making a burnt leek served with malt. I did a sauce from heavy cream and apple cider vinegar powder, served with a burnt hay cracker. So the idea come from the burning of the onions in Spain. Wrapping it in newspaper and eating it later. So I found some beautiful leeks, and it's the season right now, so we burnt them. Did the same way with newspaper to start with. We figured out how to do it a little bit faster. But we burn them, peel them, then I served it here with just malt powder, a little bit sweet, and then high lactic cream, garden sorrel, and the hay ash cracker made from oats. So we get the sweetness, the burnt from the leek, you get the acidity and the richness from the cream, and then you get sweet, malty flavor from the malt powder. And then the cracker for a little bit of texture, because the burnt leek will be a little bit soft and stringy.
Let's talk about a couple flavor profiles, and one specifically, acid, but also sour. You know, in rye, there is sour.
Sourdough, yeah, we do our own starters and stuff like that, yeah.
Outside of bread, though, the majority of sours was like Southeast Asian cuisine. How is sour important to Danish cuisine?
Sour is very important to Danish cuisine. We use a lot of vinegars, and we use a lot of different vinegars. We ferment a lot. We have a lot of we have so many more dairy products, sour dairy products in Denmark than in the US. I buy my buttermilk in, and I hide it in the walk-in, so it goes over, because then it's sour enough for my taste in my kitchen. I produce my own creme fraiche. I produce my own yogurt, because the yogurt and creme fraiche I can get here are not sour enough. And that bitterness and sourness from especially the cheese and from the dairy products I make myself are very important to the kitchen to carry the flavor profile I want to show people.
How do you control sour? How do you make something more sour?
H. And lactic acid, a little bit of cheat, but it helps a lot.
What other foods is lactic acid in?
We do some fermentation of cauliflower. We did a dish with some fermented carrots. Lactic acid is in sauerkraut. New Yorkers probably know that from their hot dogs. That's a lactic fermentation too. So it's a known flavor to people, so they're not afraid of it. But when I tell people I make my own yogurt, they go like, "What?" You know, and it's so simple and it's so easy to control. I don't think the DOH will be very happy with me, but it's a chance.
Sour only comes in a limited amount of textures. Talk about what those are and how they.
It's often in very soft textures, and you lose a lot of crispiness when you ferment stuff, and that's also why we do a lot of chips, potato chips, onion chips. We do crispy rye breads. We do rye crumbles. We do a lot of crackers to kick in the crispy texture again. We use a lot of raw vegetables again to give texture to the dishes, because otherwise it would just be soft and soft. But it's a very, very helpful way to carry the sour flavors.
Let's talk about some other chefs. Who have you met? What have you learned?
In the U.S. or in
here today?
Andre from Singapore is amazing. He's so open and fun to talk to. He's doing a cracker right now with some crab on it. I just was so lucky to taste. Michael from New Zealand. We're going to lunch after this thing. And people are so open and so... Yeah, people like to talk and chefs like to meet and talk. It's a very friendly environment here, and a lot of bouncing ideas and pictures off each other. It's very, very cool.
So how do you bounce those ideas and pictures?
We talk food all the time. And what are you doing? And how are you doing it? Why are you doing it? Where are you? Where are you from? What do you want to do? Where do you want to go? And it's just where the talk goes a lot of the time, is on food. And oh, by the way, I have this picture on my phone. You should see this dish. Or I went to that restaurant. I had that and that. Yeah, have you been there? And it's a lot of inspiration for me.
Let's talk about other technologies, because you mentioned phone. Are there other ways that you share information? Do you share?
I have a Instagram profile, and that's kind of it. I do. We do from our webpage. We throw our pictures, and we just started a program at the restaurant with. We're doing Twitter and Instagram and Facebook a lot, but otherwise, I have only been sharing with other chefs in person. Of course, I own a million cookbooks. And been through all of them. I don't own a TV, so I'm not very much into that kind of thing. And right now, I'm too busy to hunt the internet for inspiration. So it's mostly going out to eat and talking to other chefs. And that's why this World of Flavor is such an amazing place, because there are 70 chefs here, and hopefully, I get to meet everyone.
Feedback. What have you gotten as far as information from other people that you're going to start using in your own cooking?
It's more a personal saying, you know, we see what you're doing, and it's amazing. And the porridge I just did, I got so much good feedback on. It's a dish I'm going to feature on my new menu. It's more of just like going out on a limb and try some stuff that you haven't really tried before. I took this dish, of course I tested it through, and I'm proud of it. But it's also, it's nice to show to people you don't know the food. You know, you can test all you want in your kitchen and can serve it to my GM and to my owner and to my sous chef, and you know, they will speak their mind, but I kind of know their palates already. So getting feedback from other chefs here are very important, I think.
Let's talk about New York again, and you know, you're trying to bring a piece of Denmark to Tribeca, but you didn't know who your clientele would be outside of the Danes that might come there. So how did you, I know you talked about things were sweeter and things were this and that, but who did you think would come in your restaurant?
I think we just aimed to hit as many palates as possible, doing it the safe way, and then just narrowing. We've only been open for a year. And our dinner menu just started 4 months ago. As of now, I have no red meat on my, except for my steak tartare. I have no red meat on my menu. I have no, again, except for the beef tartare, I have no beef, which is very un-American. I don't feature chicken that much. I have a confit of chicken with a potato dish, but I have no chicken on my menu. And it's not on purpose, you know. It's not because I think I'm going to teach Americans to eat different. It's just what I feel like doing, and me and my team feels like doing and feel like serving. And And we use our vendors a lot, call them up and say, so what is good now? What do you prefer now? What do you have to show me? And then we go from there and make our menus. And like our butcher, Act Local, they're called AG Local, just started in New York. And they called us up one day and said, we got this amazing lamb. And we were like, cool, let's just send us some and we work with it. And that we came up with a braised lamb shank with deep fried pickled lamb sweetbreads, onion puree, and cauliflower. It's a beautiful dish. The inspiration just came from talking to one vendor and getting a sample of meat.
So it seems like I've been talking to a lot of chefs and they get a lot of inspiration, not just from the ingredient, but how to cook the ingredient from their vendor. Let's talk about society work now.
I don't get that much how to cook from my vendors. I get a lot of help from my vendors because they are very, in New York, they're very visible. They come visit us like at least once a week. Not the green guy, but I go to the green market myself. So I also meet the guys up there. And it is, again, through conversation, through meeting people, through talking to people, that the inspiration come. And then from people helping each other, sharing ideas, sharing ways of cooking things, instead of the like where the business were 20 years ago, where everything was a secret and you never gave away a recipe and stuff like that. I have no secrets. If you want to get my rye bread recipe, you're more than welcome to get it. I'm not gonna try and stop you, you know, because I might need a recipe one day from you.
Let's talk about equipment in your kitchen. Because we've talked about, you know, technology. Yeah. Do you use technologies in your kitchen, or do you try to be traditional?
Not by choice. I try to be traditional. We just opened, so our money is a little bit tight right now. I have no ice machine. I have one blender. I have one scale. You know, but we're trying. We have Rasmus, my sous chef, is very technique oriented. He used to be in the pastry department at WD-50. So we do a lot of techniques. We do a lot of things like that. We don't let one machine be our limit. You know, we're gonna try and figure out how to do this anyway, or in a different way. I was very classically French trained, so a lot of the techniques that are modern now are actually just reflections of old French techniques. Sous vide is cooking without oxygen. You know, you can do that in fat. You can do that in paper. There's so many different ways of doing it.
So let's talk about that. Let's do it anyway or a different way. What were some of those solutions you came up with?
We feature a potato dish right now with an onion powder. We didn't have a dehydrator, so we just spent 3 weeks of oven time dehydrating onions when we were not there, taking off the sheet pans and wrapping them up nicely every morning, and then back on and in. And it took, what now takes 2 days in our dehydrator took 3 weeks for the first time in the oven. So it's just adding more time.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.